On this week's 51%, meet a businesswoman whose biofuel crops include sunflowers.
What I envision is just coming together around this agricultural model, which, by the way, is beautiful.
Olympic gold medal gymnast Allie Raceman shares some life lessons and hear from a mother-daughter dance team from Haiti. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Take a look at this sunflower, standing so tall. Isn't it pretty? It started so small, but it kept growing, and it never stopped. And it's just love, water and sunshine makes it so high.
We begin our show with Dr. Sharon Ufberg and her 51% segment, Force of Nature. This time, she interviews Kelly King, co-founder of Pacific Biodiesel, the only commercial producer of biofuels in Hawaii that repurposes cooking oil waste from restaurants into non-toxic biodegradable fuel. On Earth Day in 2016, Pacific Biodiesel's Big Island facility became the first in the world to be certified by the Sustainable Biodiesel Alliance for its sustainable production and distribution practices. In addition, King's company grows sunflowers in Maui on land previously used for sugarcane production and is repurposing nut and avocado oils for sunscreen and beauty products, adding to the company's sustainable model of zero-waste agriculture, clean energy, and food. King also serves as Maui council member, and she begins by talking about why she co-founded a biodiesel company 23 years ago.
Well, personally, why I chose to do it was to support my husband, because it was an idea that he had that I thought made a lot of sense. We originally created the company to recycle the used cooking oil on the island, and it was a sort of a very large recycle project that it started out to be. It really didn't start out to be a fuel company until we got more into building biodiesel plants for other companies and, you know, one in Japan and 12 others across the U.S. But the original idea of it came from my husband being a diesel mechanic. And when he approached me with the idea, it was his third big idea, the first two having cost us quite a bit of money. So basically it was, okay, but this is the last time.
So the notion of recycling obviously is so important, especially on an island. And I know how successful the company has been. And I'm just wondering, you know, now that you are a successful businesswoman and, you know, you have taken on this election official, you know, being an official serving on the Maui County Council, I'm wondering what compelled you to run for office?
Well, that's an interesting question. It's really my community that compelled me to run for the office. I had a lot of people asking me to do it. It's not easy to unseat an incumbent in a small community like Maui, and I'm sure, you know, it's the same across the country. And so my community really felt like we needed a new representation on the council for the South Maui area. And I literally had somebody get down on his knees and beg me to run for office. And then, and it was kind of late in the game because the, you know, the election being in November, I didn't declare till April. But what I told this group of people that, you know, kept asking me was, it's too late to get into the race because you really have to spend a lot of time creating a campaign team, a manager, treasurer, grant coordinator, and all that. And they went out and found me a team in like 2 days and came back to me and said, now will you run? And really, when you think about it, it's a difficult thing to run against an incumbent, and it's not something that most successful business people want to do or will take the time to do because, you know, they're successful in doing what they're doing. In a way, that's exactly why I ran, because I think we need to get more of these successful people in the community, whether it's business, whether it's a nonprofit world, whether you're just a successful parent and a member of the community and a volunteer. We need to get more successful, intelligent people running for office, looking at it as short-term community service. I kind of look at it like jury duty. I'm going to do the time that I need to do to get something done. And as long as I'm effective, I'll run for office again. But I don't need to be here. I'm not a lifelong politician. I'm not in this for myself or my career.
what's your platform? What was it that why these people wanted you in particular to run? What were you, what's your, you know, what were you passionate about, or what change did you want to see made that you felt you needed to be elected in order to move forward?
Well, I think that we need more transparency in our government over here. And like a lot of small town communities, people know people, people make backdoor deals. You know, there's a lot of, I want to stop just short of actually saying corruption, but there's a lot of deals that get made in this county that people don't know about until it's too late. And so I'm bringing that transparency and that integrity and honesty back to the county council. And I'm opening the doors and being responsive to my constituency, which I think was one of the reasons I was the highest vote getter in the entire county race this year. Because people know me from all walks of life. It's not just business, but they know me from the nonprofit world, the social service world, the agriculture world. So there's a lot of broad stakeholder appreciation for the type of government I want to see and I want to be a part of running.
That's so admirable. I so appreciate you taking the time to do that and be a public servant. I know it can be very thankless, and it's so important that women like yourself do step up and make that kind of commitment. Tell us perhaps what's on the horizon for you and your company. I know you're doing some very new things on Maui.
Well, thank you for asking. We've always been a company that's taken a waste product and made clean, renewable fuel out of it. And there's a finite amount of waste grease and used cooking oil you can get out of one community and even out of the entire state, which doesn't come close to meeting the demand for the fuel. So we always knew we were going to have to get into agriculture if we were going to get, you know, strive to be bigger and meet those demands. So, and one of my passions has always been sunflowers. I've been working on this project for 15 years, even back when people said it'll never happen because land is too cheap. Land is too expensive and oil's too cheap. You're never going to get there. And so we come to a place where, you know, we do have a certain amount of acreage throughout the state that's designated important ag lands and will always be in ag land. And we've also come to a point where we've seen the cost of petroleum fluctuate, going very high up to $4 a gallon, going very low down to $2 a gallon. And so really the way we're going to get there is going to be a collaboration between our state, our county support, with whatever support we can get out of the federal government, which right now is waning. It's really kind of shameful the way they've gotten to the point where they're doing away with the renewable fuel standard. They're giving all the credits back to the petroleum industry and taking so many credits away from renewable fuel makers throughout the country. And we're kind of in a place where if we are going to be successful and help with some of our state and county goals, but right now the state of Hawaii has in statute the goal of being 100% renewable by the year 2045 in all of our utility power. So the only way we're going to get there is by getting support, tax credits, mandates from the state of Hawaii and also from the individual counties. So what we have to get to and what's on the horizon is getting support for that agriculture model and also the number of jobs we can bring with the agriculture model, the amount of energy security we can bring locally, and the amount of clean fuel, the environmental benefits. But those have to be recognized on a greater scale by the county and the state. So what I envision is just coming together around this agricultural model, which, by the way, is beautiful. We're envisioning 10 to 15,000 acres of sunflowers in central Maui where the sugar cane has gone fallow because the last sugar plantation in Hawaii, which was on Maui, ended up shutting down a couple of years ago. So we've got 36,000 acres of fallow land in Maui, and 27,000 of that is designated important ag lands, so cannot be used for anything else.
Yeah, I think people would love the idea of seeing those acres all sunflower fields. I think that would be, I know I was just there and saw some of your fields on my way back to the airport, and it was a beautiful sight, as well as being obviously a very, you know, productive agricultural project of yours.
Right. And we're generally a company that likes to under promise and over deliver. And so, you know, we try to make sure that what we're doing before we release it, before we launch, is workable, is beneficial, and is going to be successful. And so that first field that we did that bloomed in 2016 was not announced to the public before we planted it. And so when it bloomed, it just created this amazing phenomena where people came out to see it to the tune of 4,000 to 5,000 people a day that just came out and started walking through the fields. It was an amazing, wonderful, just joyful event that we didn't even really plan. And there was no commercialization of it. We didn't sell anything. We didn't charge anything. It just sort of raised the happiness level on the island a few notches for the weeks that those sunflowers were blooming. And we couldn't, you know, we hadn't even actually anticipated it. And we're taking that original, you know, thought, and now we're on the map with everybody on the island because they know us as the sunflower people now. And we're moving into cooking oil. You know, we're including it in our cosmetic oil line that we had launched about a year ago. And we've got this wonderful sunflower oil-based reef-safe sunscreen that we've developed. And so we're moving into sustainable, locally produced food, cosmetics, fuel, I'm assuming at some point we're probably also going to get into fiber, because the fiber that you get off the sunflower stalk is an amazing substance that can also be used for building material. We're getting into the restaurants, and we're doing kind of a wholesale bulk sales first. Our oil is actually also, we have a cosmetic grade of sunflower oil that we've been selling as a base to some of the local spas, like the Grand Wailea and the Four Seasons. I use the sunflower oil as a base for their massages in their spas. And then you can add the rose scent or lavender or whatever, the floral scents you want to it. And also some of the hotels are getting really creative. The Fairmont, just in their spa, they just created a little, it's almost like a balm. It looks like a lip balm, but it's they added the sunscreen to the sunflower oil to it. And it makes a really creamy kind of a soothing lotion that they put on there, they use for their manicures and pedicures that they put on your cuticles. So a lot of these products are just, expanding into other products, having that ingredient that's locally grown that can be connected to the sunflower field and is part of this whole sustainability model is really attractive, and it's part of the marketing now for these bulk users. And so they're also, by the way, the same, the purveyors of this cooking oil and the cosmetic oils are also the same, the restaurants and the hotels where we get the recycled cooking oil so that we can make the biodiesel out of it. And so we kind of come full circle where now they're not only using our oils from our ag farm, they're also starting to use the fuel in some of their vehicles and some of their generators. And so we're getting to a point where now, you know, the percentage of energy that we can get off the island, the percentage of food is going up, the percentage of local food and other products, and cutting down on the shipping costs, which also cuts down on the pollution because of the amount of petroleum it takes to ship everything to Hawaii.
Yes, and clearly you're a real role model for other communities to look at ways to really create that circle where you have zero waste and you have clean energy. And so I thank you so much again for being with us. It's Kelly King from Pacific Biodiesel. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
Dr. Sharon Ufberg is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in California. As her sport undergoes a national reckoning, Olympic gold medal gymnast Allie Raceman spoke before a supportive crowd at the University at Albany recently. 51%'s Ian Pickus reports.
Raceman is promoting her memoir, Fierce, How Competing for Myself Changed Everything. The 24-year-old appeared at CEFQ Arena as part of the University at Albany's speaker series. The 3-time Olympic gold medalist who competed in the London and Rio Games was greeted enthusiastically by a crowd of students, young gymnasts, and members of the community. UAlbany said about 3,000 tickets were distributed. It comes about a year after Raceman said she'd been a victim of disgraced former USA Gymnastics team doctor Larry Nassar, now in prison for sexual abuse and child pornography. Raceman memorably confronted Nassar during his sentencing in January.
Imagine feeling like you have no power and no voice. Well, you know what, Larry? I have both power and voice, and I am only beginning to just use them.
But the horrors Raceman suffered and the slow-motion dismantling of USA Gymnastics over the past several months made up just a small portion of the discussion. Late in the evening, she talked about her current work as an advocate for child abuse prevention.
For us, if one adult had the character and had been educated to do the right thing and actually cared to do it, then he would have been stopped a very, very long time ago, and it would have saved generations. And so often when there's an abuser, it's not just one victim, there's many. And, the abuse can go on for generations.
Before Raceman became an icon of the Me Too movement, she was a gifted and driven athlete. She said it wasn't her choice to start gymnastics at 18 months, but within the decade, she would beg her coaches and parents to keep practicing beyond daily time limits. Even still, a theme of the talk was that everyone has struggles, hard times, and days when they just don't want to get out of bed.
My life is not always as it seems when people tune in once every 4 years. It's not always getting gold medals and being happy and having the best performance that we can do. There are so many times where we struggle, so many injuries, so many rough days before that, so many bad competitions. And so that was really important for me to be able to be honest and to share my story and to share that there were plenty of times where you want to give up.
Raceman urged the crowd to stand up to bullying, saying she wasn't comfortable wearing a tank top for years after her fifth grade classmates made fun of her muscles. With many young people listening, she admitted she doesn't read her social media mentions. There's just too much negativity. But she says things are improving.
For so long, our society put so much emphasis on sports and winning all the time and attacking people when they didn't do the best that they could. And, and also looking the other way. If an athlete beat up their wife, you know, it was like, as long as they were playing football well, then who cared?
With the 2020 Tokyo Olympics fast approaching, Raceman has been cagey in her public statements about making another run at the medal stand. In February, she suggested repairing USA Gymnastics was more important than a gold medal. But by late 2018, it sounds like the door is still open.
People always said it was a young girl's sport, which you typically see a lot more younger gymnasts. But I think that that's changing a lot. If you look at a lot of the gymnasts from the other countries from all around the world, they're in their 20s and they're doing an incredible job. So I think it's very cool and very exciting. And I think that I feel like right now we're living in a time where a lot of athletes are doing a lot of really great things inside and outside of their sports, and we're seeing a lot of really incredible athletics, which is very cool, kind of taking it to another level and sort of proving people wrong.
Raceman added, being a good person is more important than being a good athlete. In Albany, New York, I'm Ian Pickus for 51%.
In 2010, an earthquake shook Haiti, killing at least 200,000 people. In response, some Minnesota couples adopted Haitian children. That inspired a mother-daughter dance team to move to the state and lead Afutai, a dance company dedicated to Haitian culture. KFAI's Anna Stitt reports.
In a dance studio in Minneapolis, I'm Anna Stitt. Janan Saint-Just is teaching a traditional Haitian folk dance class.
African people, Caribbean people start dancing with their pelvis because the pelvis is where life starts to happen. It's where when you make love and you have a baby.
Janan's wearing bold colors. She leads students across the floor with angular arm motions and smooth hip gyrations. Her mother, Florencia Pierre, leads seven drummers in a song. They run Afutai Dance, Music, and Arts Company in Minnesota. You could call it a tough place for a Haitian dance company, since the Census Bureau estimates fewer than 900 Haitian-born people in the whole state. But Janan says that's actually why they're here. Their story starts in rural Haiti. You could say Janan's mother, Florencia, was born dancing.
Ma mam te un reine nagara.
This is Florencia speaking Creole. She says her mother was dancing in a procession when her water broke. Rara processions mix voodoo prayer, protest, and carnival songs. On that blazing hot day, the procession stopped, and she gave birth to Florencia right there on a dirt road. She says that's why she's a dancer. And she passed on the legacy to her daughter, Janan.
Since the time I remember, I was always dancing.
In 2010, Janan was in San Francisco when an enormous earthquake shook Haiti. It killed hundreds of thousands of people. Florencia was in Haiti at the time. You'll hear her speaking Creole again and Janan translating.
Le 12 janvier, tremblement de terre vient passer.
On January 12, I was coming back from work teaching dance. I saw the hills moving closer to me and going away. I put my knees down and started screaming too, and I saw everybody screaming and running away. And I started running. I didn't know where to run or what to do, but it was unbearable.
Janan raised money to bring her mother to California. Later, a friend invited Janan to visit Minnesota. When she came,
I discovered that many white Minnesotans just travel to Haiti and adopted kids.
There's no official count of how many Haitian kids have been adopted by Minnesotans, but Janan knows of at least 28.
There's a shock of culture going on. Those kids will miss a part of their identity. When I saw that, I'm like, yes, I'm going to move here because my mission is there. I'm here for these kids.
So in 2014, Janan and Florencia moved to Minnesota. With Afu Tayi, they teach and perform Haitian dance.
So listen to the drum, connect with it, and imagine that you're a spider.
Every dance has a rhythm and a story.
Rabodai is a happy dance.
It's the dance of people coming down the mountain to sell fruit.
They have a big basket on their head, and they are so elegant and beautiful. And as they're walking, their hips are going side.
No seedless west, no seedless west.
Then there's Nago, a warrior dance.
And Nago, all the steps are very strong and deep and fierce. Like in the Haitian Revolution, there was no way to go back to Africa. If you're kidnapped and you are in Haiti, that's it. So you have to defend and fight for what you have.
In 1791, enslaved people did fight back. They rebelled against their French masters. And in 1804, they won. But instead of honoring Haiti's independence,
the U.S., France, Spain, all the big countries put themselves together just to put Haiti down. So what happened? The only picture people know about Haiti is that poverty and voodoo. Children are scared to say they are Haitian because immediately they associate them to something bad.
Janan wants to help Haitian children in Minnesota celebrate their connection to the spiritual world through dance. She hopes at some point they might say,
that drum awakened something in me that I didn't know I have.
For KFAI, I'm Anna Stitt.
The Fearless Girl statue in Manhattan that inspired millions with a message of female empowerment has a new permanent home in front of the New York Stock Exchange. The statue was removed on November 27th from its spot opposite Wall Street's Charging Bull and unveiled at its new location in early December. The hands-on-hips bronze statue was intended as a temporary display when Boston-based State Street Global Advisors installed it in March 2017 to encourage corporations to put more women on their boards. Tourists flocked to a traffic island for selfies with the four-foot bronze celebrity. City officials said the crowds were causing a traffic hazard. The Bull will join the Fearless Girl at a later date. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett and Elizabeth Hill for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1535.